Hey founders, this is the SaaS Boss Show, the podcast for SaaS founders in the growth stage who want to get unstuck, build high-performing teams, and get clarity about how to build a profitable startup. Every week, I interview SaaS consultants, coaches, and experts who work with dozens of startups just like yours and share their best strategies to overcome the daily challenges of growing a profitable SaaS. My name is Natalie Luniva, and I'm a growth and leadership coach to SaaS founders, and I'm also married to a SaaS founder, and I'm so pleased that you've joined us on this conversation. Hey, I have 10 free tickets for SaaS Stock Remote Conference happening next week, Wednesday and Thursday, and I'm excited to give them away. I am going to be one of the speakers. My session is going to be about customer communication strategies and how communications can be improved for customer success and retention. I'm excited to have you join me on this presentation. I only have one quick request from you. I'm going to be publishing a book really soon about how SaaS founders go from zero to 10K and from no customers to a few first paying customers. And I have a quick survey that's going to take you under 5 minutes to fill out. If you are up to that, please do so in the next couple of days, and I'll be raffling off the SaaS Stock Remote tickets. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you at the SaaS Stock event. Hi, everyone. Today, it is my pleasure to interview Joel Kletke about case studies, how to capture, share, and cash in on customer success stories and case studies. Joel is a sought-after conversion copywriter for SaaS and B2B, where he's helped clients like HubSpot and WP Engine turn more visitors into customers. He's also the founder of Case Study Buddy, a team of case study specialists who help great companies capture, share, and cash in on customer success stories. Welcome to the show, Joel.
Thanks for having me.
How did you start working with SaaS founders?
You know, I didn't even always work in copywriting. So immediately out of university, I knew kind of more about the type of, you know, place I wanted to be than even necessarily what I wanted to do. So long story short, I kind of fell backwards into doing SEO at a digital marketing agency. And that's where I learned a lot of the analytics side and the business side, and first saw the opportunities in business writing and copywriting and the power of that. So I went out on my own in 2013, originally doing more of the content side of things. So more blog posts and ebooks and that sort of thing. And then I was introduced to the work of Joanna Wiebe, who's kind of the queen bee of conversion copywriting. She coined the phrase and she runs a company called Copy Hackers. And so I was very lucky to be able to learn from her. And her focus was the software space and the B2B world. And through her, I kind of saw, okay, there's a huge opportunity to serve B2B businesses, but specifically software with the subscription models and the upgrades and the nurturing sequences with conversion copy work. So I started working on that almost within a year and a half of being out on my own. And it wasn't until kind of a year and a half after that, that I was asked to do a case study for a smaller software company at the time by someone who sat on the board or was an advisor to WP Engine. He's such a nice guy and so well connected. He said, "Hey, is this something you do?" And he's the kind of person you just don't say no to. So of course, I'll figure it out. Yeah. So I did a case study for a company called Pingboard. Wonderful people there. And in doing that, realized, hey, not only on the conversion side is this something that software companies really need, but also every software company on the planet can benefit from having customer success stories and case studies to point to, metrics and proof behind their name. And so I've been rolling with that ever since. We're coming up on just over 4 years of Case Study Buddy and 7 years of the conversion copy side. So most of that focused on software and B2B.
So I think that you cannot overstate the importance of case studies and success stories. Really on every step of SaaS, whether you are just starting or whether you are somewhere in between, or if you're growing your software, you really going to benefit from having at least one, preferably more than one, case study. And especially when you're just starting out, you have a few clients and you're doing cold outreach, case studies is definitely the way to go because you can just drive traffic there or, "Hey, we've done this for this client. Would you be interested to talk about how we can help you as well?" Right? So how do we go about just get our feet wet with case studies. Where do we start, really?
Yeah, and you're so right in that the great thing about case studies at any stage, but especially when you're just getting started, is it gives you an asset that's evergreen, that's going to last and be valuable to you for a long time, that you can use in multiple situations to, whether it's early funnel, bottom of the funnel, breaking it into social proof from the site. There's so much flexibility and leverage you can get out of one great customer success story. But the place to start is with where you're at. So a lot of companies, for them, case studies are just happy accidents. They wait until some client has had some huge win and comes to them and says, oh, we're so happy. But that's not really the best way. The best way to start is to, from the very beginning, have a plan for cultivating customer feedback. That's where it all begins. Because if you come in later and you say, oh, will you give us a case study, and you have no history of communicating with clients, collecting feedback from clients, responding to that feedback, then it's like a stranger is asking them to do them a favor, and it makes it that much harder. So the place to begin is looking at your SaaS platform, looking at your customer base and thinking, okay, what are some simple ways we can start systematizing the feedback process? And there's some really easy ways to do that. Sometimes it's during the onboarding phase or right after somebody signs up, asking them a single question survey. And that is, hey, what brought you into the site, or what's going on in your business that sent you looking for a solution like ours? And what that lets you do is start to get some backstory on, hey, who's coming to you? What are they coming for? What's their expectation? That gives you some ammunition later so you can check in. Let's say after a month or after you can see they've been using the platform, you can say, hey, how are things going? Have you been able to start achieving some of the goals that you had? By the way, we know the goals you had because we asked you that question when you came in. So you can start cultivating this conversation, and the companies that do this best are really deliberate about talking to customers and not making that an exceptional event. They don't just send out a survey one time a year and that's it. They kind of work on cultivating this back and forth communication. They care about customer success. The next thing to do is to think intelligently. Again, notice I haven't said get customers on the phone. We're not even at that point yet. The next logical thing to do is to think, hey, where are we headed? What are our business goals? Are we trying to reach a certain audience? Are we trying to grow in a particular sector or region? Are we trying to emphasize a certain differentiating feature? So take a step back and think, okay, where's our marketing pointing? What does our sales team need? Where are the gaps in the business goals for us? And what that allows you to do is to start deliberately looking for and planning to tell stories that support those business objectives. So for example, let's say that when you launch, you originally served small businesses, but you've since pivoted to enterprise. Well, you don't want a whole bunch of small business case studies because that's not the audience you're going after. So you want to be thinking about these business goals and doing that intelligently. Once you've systematized customer feedback, or at least thought about how you can do that and put some thought into what stories you actually want to tell, then it's time to start approaching customers. Now, if you've been collecting feedback ongoing, you've got a good idea of who might be ideal to tell these types of stories. But let's say, like most software companies, you haven't been doing that. Well, what do you do now? It can be a simple process of escalating commitment. So do something as simple as sending out an NPS score survey first. You know, out of 10, how satisfied are you with the platform? Anyone who responds a 9 or a 10 to that, follow up with a little bit more detailed survey. Hey, we loved your feedback on the NPS score. We're just really curious what you're finding value in. And ask them a few quick questions about who they are, what they got out of it. And then at that point, they've now put up their hand and given you feedback twice. It's a pretty easy leap to say, we loved your feedback to the survey. Can we get you on a quick call and tell your story and share the great work you're doing? And that's the other piece that's really important. Not just say, make us look so good and make us look so incredible, but can we put your company in the spotlight and talk about the great results you're getting and the amazing work you're able to do with our platform? And that's really how it starts. There's a lot of minutiae I can get into about how to make the ask or how to run an interview, and we can talk about all that. But getting started, those are really the three key things: is have a strategy for customer feedback, have a strategy for the stories you actually want to tell, and then escalate commitment over time or approach them to be part of that. And if you do those things, you'll have a much easier time getting to yes.
I find that so many founders, it takes for them too much time to start getting this feedback. And even if you're not at the point where you are thinking about creating a whole case study out of this conversation, I just recently spoke to a founder and he was like, I'm ready to run pay-per-click campaign, but I don't really know. And I started asking questions. So do you know what terms they're using? Do you think that this copy is going to work for them? And he didn't know anything. He didn't even know who to target. He didn't know his audience. So until you know your audience, until you speak to your customers and know what problems they have, what desires, what it is that they're trying to achieve in their own words, terms, you will not be able successful in doing any pay-per-click campaign, right? And I find so many founders target and thinking about doing SEO and writing blogs. Well, yes, you can do that, but case studies and success stories are so much easier to come up with, and they're going to be so much more beneficial because that's exactly what you can use to target, to draw your pay-per-click traffic to.
Yeah, I think exactly what you're saying. Like, this kind of customer intelligence, this voice of customer, it's the beating heart of the work that I do on the conversion side when we're trying to put together landing pages and campaigns. And you can't do a good job of that until you know exactly what you're saying, who you serve, how they talk about their need, how they talk about the desired outcomes they want. So it's not a good idea to wait until, oh, now suddenly we want to do pay-per-click, so we should go get this intel. You should be collecting that over time so you can track and understand it. I think the other really important thing is, again, the utility of a case study is going to make doing all those other things that much easier. So when you have a great testimonial, when you have a full story of how someone not only loved your product, but how they specifically benefited from this core feature or what they found to be unique about you. One of the big dangers, even for big companies who you'd think would be smarter, is they get so internal looking and the things they think are important about their platform. Like, oh, well, of course people love the fact that we can do X thing, or of course people love that it's free, you know, that we have a free tier. That's why people choose us. They get so internal that they completely ignore that the reasons their customers choose them or the things their customers care about may not be the things that they internally think are as important. So even having these conversations and capturing these stories can be helping validate and helping inform what you do on other marketing fronts and then fueling those. So an ad campaign is going to do better if you've got social proof to support it. Cold outreach. There's a study that was done by a company called HipLead. Mentioning a famous customer tripled the amount of positive responses. Can you imagine the power of sending a very simple case study? You know, very easy. Hey, you know, we work with someone in your space or someone just like you or someone who had the problem you had, made the decision you're debating and got the result you want. Being able to share that really quickly as opposed to, hey, we're yet another software platform that does this. And this is the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, in the software world, things get saturated, right? And the reality is competitors can copy your branding. They can copy your features. They can copy your content. The one thing they can't take away from you are your success stories. Those will always be uniquely yours. The success your customers have had, the results you've been able to generate, those are always going to be only unique to you. And that's what makes them such a powerful piece of content or a powerful asset over the long term, is suddenly you have this thing that's a differentiator and something that sets you apart and proves that you can do what you promise that no one can take away from you.
And I already hear founders ask this question. So what is it for those clients? What is there for them to agree to do this case study? For me, because that's talking about my company, I like how you mentioned that, no, you don't talk about your company. But still, what goes through our clients' minds that they agree to do a case study for us? Because that's a big ask.
Yeah, you're definitely asking for a favor. And it's not that you don't talk about your company at all, but you are not the hero. Your company is not the hero of the story. You are the assistant. You are the sidekick. You are empowering the client who is the hero. And I think that's something that, before I get to what's in it for them, I think something that gets missed about customer success stories is that it is about them. And these are customer success stories, not you success stories. And they're human stories. Real people, real companies, real challenges, real benefits and things you've made possible for them. So many case studies are these static, just the metrics, like, oh, they saw a 24% lift in traffic. Like, okay, that's wonderful, but what did that mean for them? Why was that important to them? How did that change their business? So treating these like human stories with tension and emotion and narrative arcs, that changes everything. Now, as for what's in it for them, sometimes nothing. Sometimes it's just they love your product and they're excited about it. They're okay to share. So sometimes that's all it takes, is if you know you've got a great relationship and they're really happy and you strike while the iron is hot, that's all it takes. But other times, that's not enough. Again, you are asking for a favor. So there are some things that software companies can consider. Sometimes it's as simple as paying for their time, saying, hey, you know, for example, we only need, if you've got a really great process for this, and this is part of what Case Study has been engineering over time, but it's others can do too, is you only need hopefully like half hour to 2 hours max of their time. Sometimes just offering to pay for that time can be incentive enough. Sometimes it's, you know, hey, we'll comp you a month of the software if you agree to take part. Sometimes it's simply mentioning an incentive can be, now this may not be the case for like earlier companies, but let's say that you've got a really active community or you've got a really powerful site, like you've got great domain authority. Sometimes it's just, hey, we've got an audience of X amount. We're going to put your company in front of them, or hey, we're going to link to you from the site. You're going to get that SEO value as well as, you know, the qualified traffic and leads. And again, the thing to really communicate to clients, because a common fear is, well, I don't want to be made to look like the damsel in distress, like we were really struggling and you swooped in to save the day. And so the really important thing is to let them know, no, listen, yes, we're going to talk about challenges that you have, but at no point are we going to make it look like we were the saviors. We're here to shine a spotlight on the great work you were doing. And the only role we have in this is helping you do it even better. So it's a lot about how you make the ask. Yes, you can incentivize, but most clients don't have to start there. You can often find low-hanging fruit, people who are just happy, and then unique to software, sometimes you can comp them a month or pay for their time, and that's often more than enough.
Do you have a lot of companies ask or mention that they don't want their competitors to know about their successes, and how do you overcome a problem like this?
Yeah, you see that increasingly with enterprise as well. And like the bigger the client, the more red tape you'll tend to run into because they have legal departments or they don't necessarily want people knowing what their secret sauce is. So there's a few different ways to handle it. First and foremost, one of the biggest allies you have, and it kind of sounds chicken and egg, but I'll explain, is a great sample. Once you've done one great success story and you can show other people you want to take part a sample of, hey, just have a read of this. Look, nothing proprietary is disclosed. Nobody looks bad. We're not sharing anything sensitive. A sample can work wonders. The other thing is underpinning that, when they say, oh, they're worried about competitors, often what they really mean is they're concerned about losing control. Control about what's said about them, control about what's disclosed, control about what they put out there. So we always encourage clients, when you make the ask, there's two things we really emphasize. Number one, that this is going to be easy for them to take part. You've got a process. It's not going to take a whole bunch of their time. Number two, they have final say over anything. You have to give them that power and the comfort of control. The other piece of this is sometimes it does come down to anonymizing the study. And a lot of founders, a lot of marketing departments go, oh, anonymous studies, they're worthless. Why would we bother? That's just not true. You can tell a really compelling, really interesting anonymous case study. And there's some simple ways to do it. So for example, one way, yes, you anonymize the brand and the company. But one of the ways that we've found kind of a sneaky workaround is you either only mention the role of the person in the company, or you give them a gender neutral pseudonym for a name. So something like Alex or Sam, where it could be male, female, doesn't matter. Something that's not going to reveal who they are. And that way you can still have those juicy quotes and specific details without actually revealing who the people behind this are. So it makes for a more believable case study. It makes for content that can be really specific, explore the relationship without putting the client at risk. And the last thing I'll say on that is we have clients who, the majority we know, they're dealing with like the Fortune 100, like big companies where like they're not going to go out there. And they even have policies internally against being publicly named in studies. But one of the things that really works for them is in the studies, we even have a line that says, you know, we were asked to anonymize this study. We're more than happy to comply. That's a massive trust builder. It shows anyone thinking about doing business with you that, hey, these guys care so much about what I want that they're willing to put aside their own personal benefit to tell a great story. So it can actually be a trust builder. But it's about giving them control. It's about making them comfortable with what the involvement will be. And then if you have to anonymize it, not the end of the world, you can still tell a really great story.
Share with us the process that we can take to build a good case study.
Yeah, so much anchors in the interview, and you have to interview your customers. Again, these are customer success stories, not you success stories. So you run major risks when you don't involve the customer in the process, because who knows if they're happy with what you're disclosing, how you're presenting them. So if that's your tactic, get that out of your mind right away. You can't do this on your own. The first thing is to run a really great interview. And the tip that I'll give to SaaS founders or anyone, you know, on SaaS teams thinking about doing this is your goal with that interview is to turn that person into a storyteller. So your goal is not to get their opinion, it's to capture their experience. You're not looking for them to just say, oh, it was really great, we love Pingboard. That's not a great case study. There's no meat there. There's no detail. Your goal is to get them to tell the story. What was going on in their business? Why did they choose you over alternatives? What was the experience of trying it out for the first time like? So to do that, a very simple tip is to structure the interview in a BDA format. Before, during, after. We see it in infomercials all the time, right? You've seen like the person trying to whip eggs and then the eggs fly everywhere. You're like, oh no. You know, like those are super cheesy, but there's a reason they're structured that way because it creates a natural narrative arc and it tells more of a story. So the before questions are things like, what was going on in your business that sent you looking for a solution like ours? What other alternatives did you consider? And why didn't you go that road? The during questions are things about the actual usage and experience of using your software. So did anything surprise you about the platform, for good or bad? We're not just here to capture positive. We also want to understand the negative because that's product information you can then work on. So while you got them on the phone, why not? But asking questions like, what surprised you about the software? What features have you found to be most beneficial and how are you using them? Questions about how they actually make use of it. And then the A, after, the results section. And the biggest tip I can give here is, yes, we all want to capture sexy metrics and great results and percentages and numbers, but even more compelling is the why and the impact underlying those metrics. Okay, you've seen a 95% increase in sales forecast accuracy using our tool. That's great. Sounds like a great case study, but what has that made possible for you? How has that changed your day to day? What has that made possible for your boss? Asking questions that prompt them to talk about not just the metric, but the impact gives you more meat to the story and more human kind of elements to weave in so people can see, okay, it's not just that they got this great, you know, metric result, but actually made a big difference for their business. So much anchors in the interview. The second thing is to consider the format you want to publish in. So everybody thinks, okay, there's only one way to tell a case study. But when you look at it, there's case studies that are short, there's case studies that are long, there's case studies that are slide decks. So think about for yourself, all right, what are our use cases that we want to use? Are we using this in cold outreach? Then it better be short and to the point because nobody's going to read a 3,000 word thing we send them in the mail. Do we want to showcase these on Twitter? Maybe a slide deck or maybe a shorter version or a link off to an HTML page network. Are we trying to use them as lead generation assets? Maybe we need both. A shorter version that teases and spells out the high level outcome, and then a longer version they can click to download to get all the juicy details that they won't necessarily see in the teaser. So thinking about format first and use case first will then help you tell that story that you've captured in that great interview in a really compelling way. And then the last little tip I'll share is so much comes down to the headline and the way that you put the story together. So for the headline, one of the big mistakes that I made when I was first writing case studies is I started every case study with a, you know, whatever the client name was, case study. So like an Elucidat case study. And like, that is the worst hook ever. No one's going to get excited by that. So headlines like how X achieved Y, how Y is doing X with, you know, your solution, X percent, whatever metric, and so on and so forth. When you're writing the challenge section, you want to set tension. You want to make it human, introduce your client as the hero right away and set the stakes. What would have happened if they wouldn't have solved that problem? In the solution section, you want to spill out not only the what they use, but why it was beneficial. And in the results, you want to make sure you're spelling out not just the metric, but the impact. So same for the interview. The same things you look for there are the stories you tell in the actual study itself.
So let's talk about how do we have those things ready. How do we actually get started on it?
I usually would start with, I mean, you've captured the story. So you determine the format you want to work on. It's a matter of making sure, okay, asking yourself the question, what's the big story here? Like, what is the one core narrative? A lot of time you'll get a lot of quotes and you think, oh, they're all great. I want to throw them all in. No, your kitchen's sinking it. Just because it makes you look good or sounds good doesn't mean it belongs in the study. So going, okay, what's the big story? And focusing on, okay, what are the details and quotes that best support that one big story? And then as you go through the sections, weaving those and only those in. You're not going off on tangents. You're not running off down another rabbit hole. So sort of as I was just saying, starting with the headline and saying, okay, what's the big impact? What's the big outcome? Making sure that's present there. As you get into the challenge section, making sure you're saying, okay, you want to open the study by setting the stakes, creating some tension. One of the most boring ways to open a study is, this is a company from this niche that has this many people. Like, nobody cares. Put that at the end of the study. If they don't know who the company is, they'll go looking for that. You know, unless it's material to the study, you can have a little block that says, okay, let's say you're trying to grow in a certain industry. So this is the industry they're from, and this, they're a small business or an enterprise, something like that. Like, give them the tidbits, but you don't need to spell the entire company bio. That's a terrible way to start things off. So set the stakes and get people invested, right? Normally the format we'll use is, this person was, you know, in a rough way, this person was trying to achieve X or struggling with X and finding it really difficult. They're finding it really difficult because X, Y, Z. If they didn't solve this problem, X, Y, Z, then they found this solution, X, Y, Z. So you kind of build off of that. When you get into the solution, you don't just, again, want to kind of just, a lot of companies just fall back to bullet points. They'll say something like, you know, our client made use of this feature, and this feature, you know, and that's the whole solution section. Like, that's not compelling. Like, you just told us these features exist. So thinking, okay, what are the main features or aspects of the software that were most beneficial? And then tying together, okay, the kind of framework to use is, they used this way and it enabled them to do this. So, or they wanted to be able to do this, they were able to do it because of this feature, and this is what that looked like. So spelling out, again, a little bit more of a story of how they actually implemented. And then when you get to the results, I mean, spoil the ending right away, like right in the headline, people should know. There's no grand reveal. It's not like, ta-da, they got this great result. Like, no, the result is the hook. But in that results section, again, make sure you state the metric right away. Like, by using the software, they got X result. This is what that's made possible for them. You know, and then you write that piece of it, kind of reflecting back, not only, okay, the metric is this, but this is what happened for them. And then make sure, this one kills me, make sure you have a call to action in the case study, because these get passed around internally. These get posted on sites. You know, especially as you go B2B, for example, like something like an average Harvard Business Review looked at, something like an average of like between 6 and 9 people involved in any one product purchase decision. Just because your point of contact knows you and loves you and is sold on it and knows how to act on the information they're getting doesn't mean somebody else does. So make sure there's a call to action, a button, some easy way to take a next step. And ideally tie that call to action back into the benefit or the pain solved for the person in the study. So instead of just saying, want a free demo? Sign up here. And phrasing it instead of something like, you know, let's say that these people saw, again, a huge increase in forecast accuracy. Ask them a question like, what would you bet, how, you know, how much would your company benefit from an increase in X percent accuracy? And then it's, you know, request a demo to find out or something, but make a call to action related to the story that they actually just read.
Besides what we've already discussed, what are some other mistakes that you see people make on this stage?
Yeah, I think a lot of people make the mistake of making it all about them. We kind of talked about that, but it's just, we did this, we did that, we're so great. It's not compelling. Another mistake is, okay, listen, if you're doing anything longer than a slide deck, you need to have a sidebar. A sidebar exists for scanners, for people who just want the gist. So the core details, like, if I should be able to only read the sidebar of the study and have a decent idea of what the big story is, because people are in a hurry, give them a place to go, whether it's, you know, a shorter version or a longer version, give them a snapshot. Make sure you're spoiling the ending, right? A lot of companies want to have this great big reveal at the very end, but put that in the headline. That is your hook. Not using visuals and headshots where possible. Visuals complement the story. So if you have, you know, their headshot, attribute it to them. Let their quotes drive the story. Let that personal side come through. If you have images of particular, you know, features or the customer, you know, working in their office, like, bring visual elements in where you can to break up this wall of text copy, or use design to kind of combat that. So use icons for, you know, displaying metrics. Do something to make it visually interesting. Don't just slap text on a page and assume that people are going to read that. Not having a CTA is, you know, a call to action is a big one that companies miss. And then not being intentional about that, you know, I know we touched on this too, but that core narrative, like throwing everything else in the mix and trying to tell 10 different stories, it's not going to work. Find the one big story, focus completely on that, and anything that doesn't support it, even if it's nice, maybe use it in a testimonial somewhere else, but a case study is there to tell one big story.
Do you have a list of questions that you usually ask people, or like a standard list that founders can also, you know, have, or does it depend on from case to case?
I think more than a list, and we do have a list of what we call our core question sets, but the danger with a list is that assuming that if you just get on the phone and ask those exact questions, you're going to get everything you need. And so a lot of people take a list and become robots where all they're doing is looking forward to the next question and not really listening to the conversation. So yes, we do have a core question set that we use as a jumping off point, but it's never the end point. So it follows that same structure I mentioned earlier. There's before questions, there's during questions, and there's after questions. So some of my favorite from each section. The before questions, I've said it a few times, but I love the question, tell me a little bit about what was going on in the business when you went looking for a solution like this. I love questions about alternatives. I love asking them something like, what else did you consider? Or one of my favorite questions, even from a product development standpoint, is what was on your list of must-have criteria when you were looking for solutions? You can literally get them to hand you the Cliff's Notes of what the boxes they were looking to check off. I love that question. In the during section, I love questions like, what surprised you? I've mentioned that one before, but I also love questions about, you know, let's say this deals with like enterprise, but it can work with self-serve sort of software too. What was rollout like? And how long did it take to understand the platform? You know, which features did you find most valuable most quickly? Which features could you not do without today that maybe you didn't anticipate coming in? So they're discovery type of questions. And then in the results section, you know, there's different ways to go at this because realizing sometimes you have to ask the same question a few different ways to get the insight that you want. Like on a live call, you're nervous, but also the person you're interviewing is nervous. And so sometimes giving them a mulligan or asking the same thing a slightly different way can yield results. So for example, not just asking, what are your success metrics? Because that's like, how do I know, right? First of all, before you even get on the call, you should be giving them homework to go pull the success metrics so they can talk about them. So they're not blindsided, because then the response you're going to get is, I don't know, I'll get back to you on that. And they will never get back to you on that. They need to come into the call knowing what to expect. But for after questions, I like asking things like, you know, forcing them to rank or decide. What's the most valuable impact the software has had for your business? What's the biggest difference this software has made for you in your role? I love asking storytelling questions. Can you give me an example of a time where using our platform came through big for you or made a difference in the way that you operate or drove a result? So questions oriented around storytelling. But I do want to reiterate, even having the best set of core questions in the world will not make you a great interviewer. It's a great starting point. But the more important thing to think about is, how am I listening to what the customer says? When do I follow up or push in? If they raise something that you didn't expect, that's really interesting. If you jump ahead to the next question, you completely miss the opportunity to tell that story. So it's not just about the core questions, but the follow-up questions and being able to dynamically listen and respond to the person on the call. So don't end with the list. Start with a list, don't end with the list.
So you mentioned just something that we have not talked about, getting clients to get ready for this interview. You've mentioned that we need to ask them for specific metrics for them to look at those metrics ahead of the call. Are there anything else that we need to ask of them? And as far as the metrics, anything specific that we want them to be ready?
We give people a list of potential metrics to talk about or things that they can consider. We know, for example, if it's an SEO software, we know the types of results clients will typically get. So we'll give them a list of options. Like if you have any notable results in traffic lifts, conversion lifts, rankings, we'll ask them to pull those things ahead of the call. The other things that are important to ask are things like, in the process of setting up an interview and getting buy-in for a case study, is, hey, who needs to sign off on this? There's nothing worse than going through the whole process, having that person be excited about it, and then, oh, shoot, we need to get approval from legal, and legal kills the whole thing. Or like the founder decide, you know, on the other side, right? Like the CEO on the other side is like, no, I need to look at it, and then they kill it. So we always try to ask, okay, who are the stakeholders? Who needs to be involved in this? Who needs to sign off so that we can help them proactively plan how to get approval on their side? And then really, it's mostly not about asking things of them, but giving things to them. So giving them control, making sure they know, hey, this is, you know, anything you want changed, nothing's going to be published without your approval. You know, really important that that's communicated. And then giving them a reasonable idea of what to expect and how long it's going to take. So we'll actually often send a list of the core questions that we're going to ask them so they can anticipate, they can kind of ruminate on what they might want to say. Some people say you shouldn't do that because then they'll be overly scripted. We really haven't found that's the case, but you know, your mileage may vary. you know, and then give them a sense of how long it's going to take. We set a hard cap. If we can't get everything we need in 45 minutes, the call is done unless they're willing to go longer. So we target half hour to 45 minutes. And if you go in knowing and having done the backstory, that's more than enough time to ask everything you need to and capture everything and then some that you'll need to tell the story.
Do you think that the founder needs to be the one asking those questions and interviewing the clients? Because what happened recently, my husband had a jaw surgery. He's the founder. And so I suggested that maybe one of his success specialists can talk to this client and interview them, which he absolutely didn't want to do. So especially since you guys are doing this on behalf of the founder, so do you think that this can bring some problems, or do you find that it's even beneficial?
I think it's beneficial. One of the challenges for founders in general is letting go. You built this thing, it's your baby, you feel like you know it so well, and only you can communicate for it, and only you can make decisions on it. It's just not true. I think the founders that do really well and build companies that really matter eventually learn how to take their hooks out and delegate. And the way that you do that is being aligned on your goals and being aligned on your strategy. And that's why when we earlier talked about getting cases, I didn't jump to, well, let's get the client on the phone. It's, what is our strategy? What are we trying to communicate? Where are we trying to grow? And the founder can absolutely contribute to those conversations. I mean, the marketing team, the sales team, different departments need to be part of that conversation because that's building bridges and getting everyone on the same page. But the huge disadvantage of having the founder running the calls, aside from that it's probably a terrible use of their time, unless you're really small and you like are the company, aside from being a really bad use of their time, you'll get biased responses. So if someone feels like, oh, I can't really be truly open about my experience with the platform because I'm talking to the founder, you're right there. We don't want to hurt, when we're talking to someone who owns something, we don't want to hurt their feelings. For some people, it can inhibit them from giving their honest feedback or make them so nervous that they give you weird, useless feedback. When you have a third party or at least someone who's, you know, an arm's length from things conducting the interview, you have the ability to really dig into the story. You can ask about the good and the bad. You can play, like we can play ignorant. So whereas like if we need to follow up a question, for example, we have the ability to say, oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that. Tell me more about that. Because we're not responsible for owning the platform, we're just acting like a journalist and investigating the story. So it's natural for a third party to be inquisitive, curious, ask lots of questions. It's not an inconvenience. So that arm's length relationship can inspire trust. It can inspire openness, and it can be a better use of everybody's time. The other thing is founders are great at building businesses. Some founders are really great at running calls. I would say the majority are not. They have trouble distancing themselves, taking constructive criticism objectively, not being in love with their concept of what their thing is. And a lot of the time, I think founders wind up uncomfortable with silence, where they ask a question, the person takes a moment to think about it, and they start jumping in and kind of filling the blanks. What about this? What about that? That's not a recipe for a good story. So either having someone other than the founder, or ideally a third party, conduct those interviews for you, someone objective, they can get a lot of intelligence that I don't think someone internal always can.
But wouldn't some information get missed because maybe you don't have background information? How do you know where to dig deeper to get them to open up exactly about the problem that the founder thinks they have, but you don't have this information?
I think that's the whole goal, is to get that information. You should never just go find a freelancer who says they run interviews and whatever and turn them loose on your clients. These are relationships you own. Part of the whole process is, for us at Case Study, but in general, you can use this as kind of a process for anyone you work with. They should be interested in your business. They should want to know what your product is. They should probably demo it or take a look at it. They should be asking questions about who your customers are and what your perceived pain points are. There's a whole onboarding process to understanding from that perspective internally and knowing, okay, for example, if we're doing interviews for software companies and the interviewer is not a person who's in SEO or has never done SEO in their lives, then they need to understand, okay, here are the types of things that companies who hire this platform have struggled with that we've seen internally. These are the types of things that we know are important to them. These are, you know, some of the ways that these features practically deploy. So it's an education process for the people conducting the interview. You don't want to turn them loose. And that's also why just having a question set will never be enough. But I think part of the misconception too is that you need to be like an absolute granular expert in the field to run a case study interview. Like, we've interviewed clients on cloud security, really complex stuff about Active Directory and like different ways that this gets deployed and responding to threats. So it's not enough to just have a core set of questions, but at the end of the day, you're a journalist. You're capturing their side of the story. You know enough, you've done your homework going in to know enough about the niche, the audience, their needs, the company strategy to have a picture of it. No, you'll never be like the subject matter expert, but it's an iterative process. And when you know that backstory, you get better and better at asking those questions, not leaving gaps, and then always securing the opportunity for follow-up. So let's say we do an interview, something really interesting came up and it got missed. We always secure the opportunity to ask one or two questions by email after the fact. So if we're doing our jobs right, 9 times out of 10, we'll capture 95% of everything needed to 100%, right? We'll get everything we need. But if there is something that we missed, normally it's not a big burden to go back and say, okay, we've got one question or two questions. Can you just elaborate on this little point? And normally that's not a huge burden, though ideally you want to make sure you get it all.
Now, moving on to our last step, talking about how to promote the case study, what are some assets that we actually need to have? Do we need to put it into a nice design, PDF, or can we just have it as a, you know, just an article on the website?
I think no matter what you do, go in thinking about the design and the presentation. And that anchors back in your use case. So how do you hope to be able to use the study? That will influence both what format it's in, the length that it's in, and the design that accompanies it. So if you're going to do a PDF design, if you're going to do an HTML page, if you're going to do a slide deck, the design needs to be beautiful. There's no way around it. It's not enough to just have a great story. You want it to look professional, look polished. You can absolutely deploy it just to a blog, but some of the ways that you can make that more compelling is to, instead of a typical, you know, problem solution results format, sometimes you can break it into a question and answer type interview, or do both. You can have a case study on one section of the site, say your resources section, and repurpose that into a Q&A interview using the exact same interview as a piece of blog content, and repurpose that into a slide deck. So it really comes down to the use case and how you actually want to be able to deploy these things.
So let's talk about promoting those case studies. How can we best benefit from what we already have? Because we talked about having this as an evergreen piece of content. What do you think the most successful companies make use of this?
So the most successful companies think about how they can use this. Not only, like, the least successful companies just chuck them on a resources section of the website and just leave them to sales, the sales team, to use at the bottom of the funnel. The most successful companies proactively, because they've done this thinking initially about the strategy and how they want to be able to use them. For software specifically, there's some use cases that I absolutely love. Number one is if you're really small and you're doing cold outreach, I mentioned that HIP lead study earlier, having a slide deck or a really short piece of content, super easy promotion, easy to plug right into your cold outreach. Let's say you're doing a nurturing sequence. So someone signs up for a free trial, they've got their 30 days, you want to be able to give them content that's useful. Well, if you've done your planning, now you have the ability to tell a story about people who've been successful with the platform. If you've asked them the question when they onboarded, what they were trying to get out of it. So a really great example of this is FreshBooks. FreshBooks asks you in the beginning, like, what are you hoping to use FreshBooks to do? And then they give you a tailored nurture sequence based on your stated goal. And in that nurture sequence, they have case studies of people who've achieved that goal. That's a really smart, practical way of using case studies. Another thing you can do, let's say you've got existing customers, and like a lot of software, you've got maybe 2-3 tiers, right? You've got free and basic and pro or whatever. You can use these for nurture sequences to upgrade. So let's say you've got a customer who's been happy on one platform. You think they might be ready to upgrade to the next one, but they're not taking any action. A pretty logical, sneaky way to reach out is to say, hey, here's an example of someone who upgraded. So if you can capture case studies on people who went from plan one to plan two, maybe that applies for you, maybe not. Another way that I love that isn't on the radar of a lot of software companies, but should be, is customers who have churned. So someone tried the platform, they went through your trial, 14, 30 days, whatever, they didn't stay on. They've never come back, they've never used it since. The question is, how do we logically open up a discussion with this person again? And you can either wait a long time till you made improvements to the platform and send them a message like, hey, we've made a whole bunch of improvements to the platform. Come check us out again. But another natural way to reach out is to send them a success story, especially if you know a little bit about them or what their goal was or the use case was. So I've seen email templates as simple as, hey, is X stated goal or whatever still important to you? Here's a quick case study of someone who used our platform for that. Would you be interested in trying us again? That's all it takes. So you can even use these customer success stories and case studies in your win back emails with your churned customers. So the smartest companies don't just chuck it on their website and go, all right, we did that. They think about how they can use them at the beginning, in the middle for nurturing, at the end for upgrades, and even for people who churn out.
Do you have some examples of results that companies were able to achieve with using those case studies effectively? What are some results that clients achieved? Any in particular that stand out?
Yeah, I mean, one of our early customers, Rankings.io, they're an agency. They work with a lot of lawyers. They closed over 200,000 in new deals, introducing case studies into their sales process. So they're within the first month of having them, they were able to close more deals with their cold outreach and with people who they're onboarding. There's a learning platform called Loop. Now I have to look back at what the actual stat was, but they put case studies into use. And I have to look, we have the case study on our site, but it did wonders for their close rates as well. So a lot of companies see higher close rates to that. We're going to be publishing a story about CartHook. CartHook is a client of ours who has baked these case studies into their ads, into their outreach. And we just did an interview with them that talks about kind of some of the results that they've seen, but they've seen huge upticks in terms of interest and clicks and conversions on their advertising campaigns, never mind bottom of the funnel sales type stuff. I don't have that exact metric in front of me. Another agency, Tiller, doubled the effectiveness of their sales process. You know, so they started closing twice as many deals once they started being able to bake these case studies into them. And then practical use cases, you know, we've seen it. One of the difficult things with an individual content asset is it's not necessarily just like a landing page. You can deploy it, run an ad to it, see one exact conversion rate. But we have seen case studies play a role in assisted conversions or being introduced to nurture sequences and then seeing an uptick in people convert or stay on the platform and those types of things. So there's loads of ways to use them. Sometimes they drive assisted conversions. Sometimes they drive conversions directly, though that's much harder to measure. But a lot of the time you see these improvements in sales close rates, content in terms of traffic, that sort of thing.
Is it something that you help companies with? Do you also help them identify opportunities, how they can use these case studies in the most efficient way?
It's increasingly where we're going. One of the things we know and have learned as a company is that our success depends on not only delivering a great experience and a great product for our client, but their ability to be successful with that asset. So today, you know, we kind of do it in a loose way. We follow up after we've given someone a case study, we follow up within a month to see how's it going. How have you deployed this? Is there a way we can help? We do give them some assets to help. So social media sharing images, you know, if they want to promote it on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, where they're active, we arm them to do that. On our roadmap and our goal over time is to evolve. We started as very much a productized service company, just producing these. As we realized, hey, there's this whole other thing of actually putting them to use, it's become increasingly important to help there. So increasingly over time, we are playing more of a role in the strategy side. Today, during our onboarding, we ask about use cases. We help them decide on the best formats for them. We help them plan a little bit what types of stories they need. We create those promotional assets on the other side. We can build the pages, the testimonials, those types of things. But over time, the goal is to be more and more involved in that, drawing the line at, we never want to be the people running your ad campaign. We'll just give you the assets to do it. So helping companies think about this, helping them deploy the assets that make sense, and then some consulting surrounding, okay, for you, in your unique scenario, this might make sense or this might make sense. So it's increasingly something we're doing, but still a role that we're growing into.
Where can founders learn more about you?
Yeah, for the company, casestudybuddy.com has breakdowns of our process, lots of samples so you can see other software companies, agencies, coaches, B2B businesses that we've worked with. So tons to dig through there. Last month in March, we had done over 100 of these between like last September to March in multiple formats. So we do a ton of this. Casestudybuddy.com, there's articles where you can learn how to do this better yourself, samples you can learn from, you can hire us if that makes sense. And I post a lot on LinkedIn as well, just talking about conversion copy, case studies, how to use them. So that's another place people can tune in if this sort of thing is of interest to them. And Twitter as well.
Is there a book that was most impactful for you? Anything that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Yeah, I think there have been a few, mostly on the copywriting side, but one of them is called Made to Stick. And just in general, not even specific to case studies, but just to communicating ideas as a whole, that book really does an amazing job of breaking down strict criteria for how to make an idea sticky and interesting, how to communicate better. And I think that's a huge talent, whether you're a marketer, a salesperson, a founder, being able to communicate in a compelling and memorable way will never not be an asset for you. So Made to Stick was really huge for me on that front. And then for those who are just trying to become better writers or better sales writers, Dan Kennedy's Ultimate Sales Letter is another great book. It's a little bit old school. He focuses on kind of the principles of direct mail. So, you know, actually sending a letter through the mail, but so much of what he does there applies everywhere, online, in emails, on websites, in sales sequences, even lessons that you can bring across into case studies, especially for things like headlines. So those two books are very worthy reads.
Are there any other questions that I didn't ask you but should have?
That's a good question that I we like asking that on case study interviews too. No, I think if I want listeners to walk away remembering anything, even if they forget my name and all of that stuff, I think the biggest thing is just that these are not you success stories, they're customer success stories. You have to involve the customer, you need to go in with a plan, you need to have a strategy. These are such amazing differentiating assets for you. They're proof nobody can take away from you. And as you operate and as competitors come in, as things get more saturated, those are going to be your big competitive advantage.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for this episode. For those tech founders who have a remote team, I have a question. Do you find yourself that it's much faster for you to do things by yourself than waste all of that mental energy delegating tasks to someone, and so you either don't hire anyone, or if you already have a remote team, you're guilty of doing those tasks by yourself because there's just so much energy goes into delegating the tasks and then just managing people. Are you able to take a few days off and not be worried that your servers will go down or your support is going to blow up? What if you could work on more strategic, important things and let your team fix the bugs? If you only started building your team in the last couple of years, I guarantee that you are making lots of mistakes that hinder your growth without even realizing that. Oftentimes, you, the founder, may end up being the bottleneck to your team's success. That is definitely hard to swallow, but it's true. But also look on the bright side, this is also the easiest problem for you to fix because you are in control of how to fix it. I'll be launching soon a program that will help tech founders improve your team performance and as a result, remove the roadblocks to scaling your SaaS just by improving your operations and team dynamic. This is really the shortcut. To be notified when it's live, go to my website, natalieluneva.com/team. natalieluneva.com/team.